If there's one experience North Floridians all share, it's the smell of smoke in the early spring. It comes from fires started, intentionally, by humans. But fire has been in Florida long before people arrived.
What we find in Florida is that fire was always present on the landscape.
This is Dr. Angelina Parati in a clip from WFSU's recent documentary, Finding the First Floridians. She studies pollen, fungus, and charcoal found in sediments. I interviewed her to learn about Florida's Ice Age landscape, to understand what it was like when people first arrived here at least 15,000 years ago. Back then, Florida was dominated by open, grassy landscapes filled with large herbivores such as bison and mammoths. And from time to time, it burned.
Prior to the decline of mega herbivores, those mega herbivores were reducing the vegetation enough that even when there were fires, maybe they weren't big enough or widespread enough to leave a big record in paleoecological archives. But after their extinction, we see a pretty significant increase in fire.
As Ice Age grasslands became modern longleaf pine savannas, fires burned more frequently. But how frequently?
Is there like a fire season in Florida? Is it winter or is it summer when it's hotter? But summer has a lot of rain, so plants obviously grow back. How do the animals adapt? Let's say you burn a section. Do they migrate to another area? Do they come back? What's the usual behavior around that? Is this a practice that is like a natural practice, like from the indigenous people? Or how was this adopted, the prescribed burns? And are these controlled burns, is it a schedule or do they go kind of by what the land's behaving like at the moment? If they see a potential threat, then they do it. Or is there like a set routine?
That's my high school friend, Ika Macosta. She came up with the name for this podcast, and we'll talk to her later in the show. For now, we'll seek answers to these and other longleaf fire questions, not in sediments, but in the trunks of trees. We talk time-traveling tree trunks on Coast to Canopy, the podcast on a quest to find the essence of natural North Florida. I'm Rob Diaz de Villegas with WFSU Public Media. My guest in the studio is Dr. Jean Huffman. She's a dendrochronologist with Tall Timbers Research Station in Tallahassee.
Dendrochronology, dendro means tree and chronology time, so it's looking at the records that are held within trees, but my work specifically does fire history, so that's my particular interest in dendrochronology is finding the history of past fires.
Gotcha. And so we have here between us in the studio on the table a couple of cross sections of, I guess, longleaf pine trees.
This one's a slash pine and this one's a longleaf pine.
Okay, yeah. And so, of course, when we talk about the record contained within trees, we're talking about tree rings, right? And so we can see the rings here. So describe what's the information contained within these rings. What are we looking at?
Okay, well, I'll start with this little one. And this is from the St. Joseph Bay State Buffer Preserve. And it only has like about 12 rings. And I use it as a demonstration to show kids and other people what a tree ring is and how you can look at fire scars. So a tree ring consists of the early wood, which is light colored, a band of early wood, and then a band of late wood that's dark colored. So those together make one annual ring. And this section has a fire scar. It just happens to be from a fire that I did as the manager at the Buffer Preserve. I conducted a fire, and it happened to scar this tree. And you can tell two main things about fire history from these scars, and that is the year. So dendrochronology is the science of exact dating tree rings. And so it's not difficult in this one because it has bark and you know when it was cut and it only has a few rings. So that's easy as far as year, but you can also tell the timing, the seasonal timing of when a fire occurred by where the actual scar occurs within the ring. So this particular scar is at the end of the early wood, right before the late wood starts. I've done other research that assigns months to the position of the scar within the ring, and that means that this fire happened about in June.
Right. Yeah. And so You have a presentation you do, and I saw one of your slides you show. I mean, you kind of can go in a little bit closer, I guess. What do you use to look more closely at the tree ring? I say it almost looks like I can see the cells of the wood.
Right. Well, generally for fire history, you have to take cross-sections of trees. And so most all of what I use are stumps, are old stumps. And what you have to do is take a cross-section and then surface it, sand it really finely so that you can actually look at it with a microscope. And when you look at it with a microscope, you do see the cellular structure, you know. When I first started out in tree rings, all the work was done with a microscope and a manual measuring stage. How you date these things is by measuring every ring and looking at the patterns of growth. So that used to be done manually with a measuring stage and a microscope. But in the last years, like most things, now there's a system that you can do it digitally. So I surface the cross sections and then scan them with a high resolution scanner. And then you can look at the rings on a computer screen and measure the rings digitally on the computer screen, which is a great advance in in ease of interpreting and dating these trees.
I bet. And then so I'm looking here and I see some of the dark bands are wider and some are narrower. So what does that tell us about those years, I guess?
The thing that makes us be able to use trees for historical records is the exact dating. And the exact dating is possible because trees respond to environmental factors across, you know, a population. So in this case of the longleaf and slash pines, the environmental factor that the growth response is most tied to is rainfall. So in years where the rainfall is really low, you'll have a narrow ring, and where there's more rainfall, you'll have a wider ring. So that pattern of years and size of the ring is what allows us to make a growth chronology that allows dating of ones that don't have a known outer date.
Are there any other types of scars than just fire scars? So could you see if a hurricane hit or any other sort of weather event? Uh-huh.
Yeah, anything that injures the cambium of a tree will cause a scar. So in my trees, sometimes there's a big area of cambium that's killed and wood removed, and that shows cat face scar from, you know, when people were doing turpentine operations and cat facing the trees or scraping the bark off so that they could extract the resin. So there are human type scars, like up north where indigenous people stripped bark for various reasons and things. So you can get human history, human injuries. You can get insect injuries. So if a bug gets under the bark and chomps the cambium a little bit, that will cause a scar. And then there are, of course, the fire scars. So when I'm looking at these, I do see other kinds of scars.
Gotcha. Another thing that kind of surprised me about your presentation was looking at tree rings to get a fire history has been done quite a bit in the country, but not a lot of the studies happen down here in the South where our ecosystems are the most fire-dependent. Why is that?
Right. Well, when I started doing this work, which was about 1998, there were no fire histories whatsoever for the Southeast. And there are several reasons for this. One is that you need old trees that have recorded these. And because the Southeast coastal plain was logged so extensively, that there are very few old trees left. But the other thing is you can get this kind of information from stumps and dead trees, but in the Southeast, most stumps were removed. So the resin that's in the trees that they did for turpentining, it's also in the stumps. So in the 40s, and actually even now, wholesale removal of stumps across the landscape. So there's not an abundance of the fire scarred material, the trees that you use to make fire history reconstructions. But the other thing is there haven't been a lot of people looking for it. there haven't been a lot of dendrochronologists here. Out west, there are literally, I mean, just hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of studies. Just a huge number, and also in the north and stuff. But the southeast was a big gap. And another reason for this was that you could look at a cross-section of a stump or of a tree, and there'd be no fire scars, because longleaf pines are super fire resistant. And actually, if they do get an injury, like a cat face or something like that, they tend to burn up and die, because the resin on the face and all. So people weren't finding a lot of fire scars if anybody was looking. There weren't a lot of these external fire scars. It's where there's an injury and then the cambium starts to heal and it makes what I call a curl. It curls over, trying to close up that injury. And every time the fire comes, that tissue is sensitive and so it makes a scar. That's a lot of the fire histories that had been done up to that time were based on external scars. What was the real breakthrough for making fire history here in the Southeast was what I found after I did a first fire history was the little St. George Island that had these external scars that were caused because of the previous cat facing, but it didn't go back very far. When I started collecting from old stumps at the buffer, my husband Neil, who does all this work with me, and I were able to sample some of these stumps all the way down to the ground. You know, they were turned up. And so we could sample them right at the base, right at the interface, like of the roots and the shoot, the bole of the tree. And what we found there was lots of fire scars. And that was the incredible discovery that has made all the subsequent old fire history reconstructions that go back far in time is because we could find scars. Whereas if you sampled up just, you know, 6 inches up, there are no scars. Oh. But right there at the base, there were lots of scars. And that's because they're so fire resistant, the trees are, but things fall at the base, like pine cones, branches, lots of pine needles. So the intensity of the fire can be very hot in different places. And so that's why they have scars there when they don't have scars anywhere further up. So I think that that had a lot to do with why there haven't been fire history reconstructions in the Southeast very much.
Yeah, and I guess during a prescribed fire, if you look at one, you know, especially if the area has been burned a lot, fires aren't very tall to begin with.
Exactly.
So it makes sense to be lower down.
Exactly. And also the fact that there aren't scars, you know, because fires are so frequent, there's very little fuel. So a fire up north in a type of habitat that burns every 30 or 40 years has very intense fires that do scar trees. Here, historically, the fires were so frequent that they don't get those high fuel accumulations that would have made scars.
Right. So you mentioned a little bit ago how much of longleaf habitat in the Southeast has been logged, and it's something like 90% of it is gone from the historic, or is it even more than that?
I think it's like 99 and a part.
Right, right.
More than 99%.
And of course, now people are trying to restore a bit of it in different places. And talk about, you know, the importance of knowing this information that you can get from these stumps.
This is sort of my motivation for all of the research. So before I started doing this work, I did land management, and I'm a prescribed burner. And you realize that people set the agenda as to fire regimes now, you know, in natural areas where fire is very important. We decide how often and what timing of the year, what season that fires occur. But what information do we have about it? You know, nobody took records before 1900 or so. And the big question was, what was the fire regime in the past? What were fire regimes like here? I and a lot of land managers, fire managers, are very curious as to how this area burned in the past, especially pre-European settlement, you know, what were the fire regimes like? What I found with my first studies, like the Little St. George Island, is that even though it was an island, fires were pretty frequent, but this was just, you know, post-1860. But then for my dissertation work, I did a study at the St. Joseph Bay State Buffer Preserve, and there I had these old stumps, and I had just discovered the methodology that the scars were low, and so I only had six trees, but from those six trees, I could find out that the fires were, you know, 1 to 3 year interval, and mostly in the growing season, at the transition season between the early wood and the late wood. Anyhow, that information, one of the things that makes me happy about doing this work is that it is useful to managers. So previous to that, FNAI, which is the Florida Naturals Area Inventory, that kind of sets a standard of different habitats and how often they would have burned and all that. They had, I believe it was either a 2 or 3 to 5 year interval is what they thought it was. But after my research showed this, they actually changed the interval to 1 to 3.
Okay.
So it's like that made me very happy that this work has, you know, some influence and application as we learn about these systems that it could help. But what's been really interesting is my most recent research that's at the Tyndall Air Force Base, you know, near the Buffer Preserve. This is with my husband, Neil Jones, and Kevin Robertson, and Monica Roth, or other people from Tall Timbers. We have collected many trees and sampled them low and have a really complete record. And we have been very, I have to say, surprised to find that the fire interval during the period from like the late 1500s to the late 1700s, even into the 1800s, was annual. Wow. You know, the fire frequency was very, very, very frequent. And also, it was mostly in the late spring, summer season.
Okay, so there's a few things there I want to follow up on. So seasonality, and then also just the age of the trees. But first, you talked about FNAI setting had previously set a standard for burning every, you know, 3 to 5 years. And what happens after you get past 3 years or so of burning? Talk about like what happens to an ecosystem the less fire is applied to it.
Well, it turns out that this 3 year threshold is very important. So looking at pine flatwoods, if fire is applied more than every 3 years, if you have gaps that go more than 3 years, it shifts towards woody dominance. So towards increased palmetto, gallberry, all kinds of woody species. And that's basically a 3 year tends to keep it at equilibrium. Less than 3 year makes it less woody, and more than 3 years, it gets woodier. And you can see this extremely clearly at the Tall Timbers fire plots,
yes,
where they, for many decades, have burnt plots 1, 2, 3, 4, and more intervals that were set up by Herbert Stoddard at Tall Timbers in the, I think, 1950s or 60s. I think 60s. Anyhow, what they found doing this is that when it got over 3 years, it became so shrubby and so closed in that fire wouldn't really even carry anymore. It was only the 1 to 3 that maintained it at all, and the 3 was borderline. It's the 1 and 2 was what maintained these open, basically sort of grasslands or savannas, you know, where that you have this really diverse, beautiful ground cover of wildflowers and grasses. If your fire frequency went higher, you lose it, and it becomes a shrubby thicket.
So when you talk about like woody growth, we're talking about longleaf pine trees are kind of widely spaced apart, depending on, you know, different settings. There's a lot of grasses and wildflowers and things growing between them, right? And some what we call woody shrubs, the hardwood trees. So these are oaks and other types of things like that, right?
Right. Historically, these areas burned frequently and they were open like you describe. But when fire is excluded, what moves in is like tree species that like laurel oaks and water mm-hmm. oaks, things that wouldn't survive a fire. So right. historically, they weren't in the system because they couldn't get established because of the frequent fire. So those things move in. And then the shrubs that are there naturally that are kept low by frequent fire just explode. So it gets full of hardwood tree species and shrubs that weren't there originally. It basically results in the loss of the ecosystem, you know, loss of the wildlife of things like gopher tortoises and bobwhite quail, which was the focus of Tall Timber's research that really brought to light how important fire was to maintain these ecosystems, the plants and the animals.
And so there's a lot of restoration that's going on right now in the Panhandle and throughout the Southeast, but I know there's various projects I've covered, and sort of a goal of that would be to get to something kind of like how it was before. Mm-hmm. And to know that, I guess you need to find some of these older tree stumps. And talk about not only just finding older trees, but building, I guess, a key for an area going back even further so you know how was fire then.
Yeah, actually, the first study that I did was, you know, like I said, the trees on Little St. George Island that were 1850s onward. Mm-hmm. But the second site was the buffer preserve, which was stumps. And these stumps, because of the previous stumping across the landscape, they're quite rare, you know. So it was an amazing discovery to find these. But, of course, we didn't know how old they were because nobody had worked with them before or dated them. That was the focus of my research, was to make a growth ring chronology that started in the present and went back, a pattern of narrow and wide rings that I could use to date these unknown stumps. And what we found is they dated to the 1500s, 1540, 1530 for the oldest ones, and only went up to the early 1800s. So these stumps, and some of the stumps, the outer date is like the 1700s. So that the stumps, especially in trees that were cut, you know, trees that were cut by people, the tree does some kind of process that makes the stumps full of resin, like sort of like concrete, and they really persist for hundreds of years in the right conditions. The buffer study kind of brought the fire history work back to the 1500s. Right away.
So you're kind of working your way backwards. So you have like, you know, from a modern tree, you know that, you know, when it died, so you can count backwards there. And then you find overlap in skinny and wide rings and fire scars and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you keep going back and back and back. Mm-hmm. That's really cool.
That's called cross-dating. Yeah. And it's a basic thing of dendrochronology, a basic tenet that allows all this work to be done.
Yeah.
But it's been really interesting. So my husband Neil and I started in 1998 with the Little St. George and then the buffer. But then people would tell us about a stump here or there, and over the years have discovered these things. And these stumps are being lost, you know, because of development. Look at peninsular Florida.
Right.
You know, there's not that many natural areas left, let alone natural areas that have old growth stumps. So there's development of these few old stumps that are left. And then they do eventually burn. You know, these are fairly fire resistant for a while. But if they get any injury to the stumps, they burn up. And so stumps burn up, they're lost to development, people collect lighter wood, whatever. They're rare, and they're getting more and more rare. And they contain all these records of the past. Like, nobody recorded records of fire regimes in the past, really, even into the 1900s. People didn't say, oh, these fires were so frequent. Then this goes into periods of time when there weren't even very many people on the landscape. So these records that these trees contain are irreplaceable. There's no other records like this of a fire in particular. I kind of recognize the value of these amazing stumps, and nobody was protecting them or collecting them, archiving them. And so Neil and I have taken it on ourselves. So it wasn't my job, but for the last, 25 to 30 years, we've been going around and collecting these sections and basically protecting them so that these records could be looked at a later time. And we've collected over 50 sites within Florida, South Georgia. And just this past year, we've gone also to North Carolina and Central Georgia. But we've collected from the Seminole Reservation in South Florida to South Georgia and all many places in between. More recently, we've done collections in cooperation with other people, like at Gothy State Forest with the Florida Forest Service staff, the manager there, who was really interested in knowing what the fire history was there and helped us collect. And so I have a pretty large collection, definitely the largest collection of tree ring records for the Southeast anywhere.
Kind of exciting to hear that you're branching out from Florida. I imagine, Florida is flatter than a lot of other states and gets a lot more lightning. And how would it be different in North Carolina, where there's, more terrain and it's, less lightning, or,
Yes.
That'd be...
Yes. But the thing about the stumps is that it's rare that you find, like we found at Tyndall, the 30 stumps in one little area. And that's what you use to make a good fire history reconstruction, since all of the trees would have been recording fires that happen in one little small area. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times what you find is one stump here, one stump there. And you can't do a fire history reconstruction from that, because any one tree only records some fires. You need a number of trees to really get the accurate record of how many fires were going on. I'm looking forward one day to taking all these stray samples from all over and looking at the seasonality of fire for them, because you have a record of when the fire occurred, that you don't need a series of trees for that. Maybe someday down the road.
yeah. But I'm glad you brought up seasonality. Talk about when they burn from what you found and why that's important. Like, what effects you have if you burn in the winter. Like right now, we're recording this April 2nd. The last 2 weeks, I've seen large clouds of smoke over Tallahassee and ash raining down. Talk about why it's important when you burn.
The seasonality of fire is really interesting. Most of the burning that's gone on in the last 100 years by people for cattle in South Florida, South Central Florida, and it used to be cattle in North Florida as well, and for forestry, mostly occurs in the winter, dormant season of trees. And we were curious as to, what was the season of past fires. And a lot of people say that indigenous people, burned, and some reason they think that they would have burned in the winter, like post-settlement people did. And so a lot of people expected there to be a lot of dormant season scars. What we found was that, pre-Euro settlement, pre-1800, say, the vast majority of the scars we found were in the lightning season, were in the May, June, July period of time. And that's the transition of the early wood to late wood. It was a surprise to see that this was the case over this 350-year period of time. And I have a slide I show in the presentation that shows the seasonality of current burning versus the seasonality of past fires that we see in the tree ring record. And it's very different. This centered around June for the historic record, and centered in the winter and early spring, so December, January, February, March, for current burning, or even into April. And, you know, as a manager and a fire ecologist, I've seen that there's a big difference in what happens when you burn in the one season versus the other, when you burn in the summer versus the winter, or not the summer, but, you know, that the historic period of time versus the current. I have a couple examples of ecological changes that occur with changes in fire seasonality. And the one is fire in wetlands, you know, fire, how it moves across the landscape. The historic fires occurred right at the end of the dry season, and they were ignited by lightning in the beginning of the wet season. So the landscape was really dry, very dry. Yeah. And a stray fire would start, you know, outside of where it was raining and burn a lot and burn so frequently that it would burn across the grassy wetlands, and that's what the landscape was like, that most of the wetlands or a lot of wetlands burned as well. When the fire season with cattlemen and forestry shifted to the winter wet season, it stopped going into wetlands. And what happened with those wetlands that had open grassy edges and even interiors with cypress, which is very fire tolerant, they were very open and grassy. But when the fire was switched to the winter and these fires didn't go into the wetlands, they became shrubby. So we have a shrub here called Tai Tai that just went crazy. And Chuck Hess, who worked in the National Apalachicola National Forest, has mapped the National Forest, you know, from the old aerials where the wetlands were still open to current. And it's, I believe it's over 100,000 acres of wetland that shifted from open grassy to absolute dense thickets of Tai Tai. And the other thing that happened when the seasonality of fire shifts like this is that when there's no fires in the wetlands, the leaves and everything goes to the ground and decays and makes what they call duff. So in the past, the bottoms would have been sandy, and now they're covered with a thick layer of duff. And it's ecologically completely different. And so things like a flatwood salamander that had to have that open habitat, they can't survive. So you have this species, flatwood salamanders, that were very common. But they were very common in this landscape of fire that went in wetlands as well as uplands and was very frequent. Now they are next to extinction.
In 2022, Florida Fish and Wildlife biologist Pearson Hill led us on an expedition to find frosted flatwood salamander eggs. We found some in a wetland near Sumatra in the Apalachicola National Forest.
Flatwood salamanders still occur in that St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge and here on the Apalachicola National Forest. I can't say how many are left at St. Mark's, but there may be, you know, 1,000 to 5,000 there. On the Apalachicola National Forest, it's almost certainly less than 500 adults, maybe down to 100 adults. And if you do the math there, the adult population size is critically low. I consider them to be functionally extinct out here, which means they're no longer, you know, filling their niche. Even where they occur in such low densities that they just are there nominally. I would say there's three breeding populations out here that are moderately robust. Everything else is just, you know, on the verge of extinction.
For people at home who are kind of wondering about a burning wetland, let's talk, you know, this is an ephemeral wetland, right? So seasonally would have water. In the winter, it's dry and grassy. And it's sort of like the place we went to was sort of a very open area, very grassy. And then there's this little cypress wooded area where the ground got lower. And the one that had been burned that he took us to, there's a lot of grass between the cypress trees. And then you're saying when there's not fire, all between the cypress trees, it's like woody and thick. And not a lot of space for a little salamander or all the things in its food web to...
The plants and animals in this system evolved with this type of fire. And so for some species, when you move fire out of that window that it was most common in the past, it can really negatively hurt them. And that, so, for instance, in the fire record, there are almost no fall fires. You know, that just wasn't a time. And now, in my fire history records from the SCARS, you know, most of the fires were in the June area, but there were dormant season fires. There were some dormant season fires, some fires at other times of the year, but very few in the fall. And it turns out that flatwood salamanders, their adults migrate to the wetlands in the fall. They live underground most of the time, but they are up on the wire grass. And if you burn in the fall, you'll burn up the adults. It's really interesting that there are other species that also respond to that certain season. So wiregrass, which is a dominant species of undisturbed, you know, old growth ground cover sites, one of the predominant natural grasses in these systems. It was thought for a long time that it never flowered, but that was because the burns were all done in this winter to very early springtime, which doesn't stimulate the flowering and seeding of this species. But as soon as people started burning in May, June, it flowers like amazingly. Really? And it's because it's, you know, has adaptation to this specific seasonal timing of fire.
Right. So in a way, a lot of these plants and animals sort of tell us a little bit about when the
absolutely
seasonality. So and that lines up with what you're seeing in the, in the record. So that's
it is pretty very cool. Very cool.
So another thing I've heard is you know, people have a hesitancy to burn during the growing months because, and I guess intuitively, we see a lot of green growth and we see a lot of things that look really alive compared to the winter when things look really dead. And talk about what happens when you burn when things look really alive. Like what happens within the next month or two after a fire in June?
Well, when you burn in the winter, it takes a while for things to come back, you know, to sprout back. They do. But when you burn in the spring, summer time, it just comes back really rapidly. So it may be green, whatever, they lose that little bit, but they just come back gangbusters. And then it stimulates flowering. It actually stimulates synchronized flowering. Mm. So if you burn it that season in the fall, you'll have a phenomenal bloom of liatris and all kinds of asters, and it's synchronized. And what's really kind of cool also is that it synchronizes them to flower when the butterflies migrate through. and hummingbirds and butterflies and stuff like that.
Right. So if you burn in summer and in a couple months later, you have a lot of flowers when monarchs are flying down. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, we started talking about cypress wetlands. And so another thing in your presentation that I thought was really interesting, and, you know, fire went through wetlands with cypress trees. And doing the same kind of study with them. Have you started that yet, or is this more of a thing you're thinking about?
In this process of finding stumps and people telling us about stumps, some people that have land in South Georgia told us about a lake that they have that used to be a kind of a cypress flat, but a long time ago. It was dammed and made into a lake like in the 1800s. And so they drain it every 12 years, and the bottom of the lake is just full of cypress stumps. Mm. So when they drained it this time, they asked if we might be interested. And so we went and took cross-sections of these cypress. And, you know, cypress gets very old. So like one little tree trunk that's about 12 inches had 500 rings. Wow. It's really old. This presented a situation where we could test this idea about basal scars and sample the stumps at the base. And I was very excited to find evidence of fire scars in cypress. Nobody has ever looked at fire frequency in in Cyprus systems, and it's much less understood than in uplands. Fire and wetlands is much less studied, much less known, and very interesting. And so it's exciting to find these, but we would love to do fire history work from them, but we haven't been able to because I have so much work to do finishing up these studies already started, and we're looking for funding to help do it. It will be really interesting to expand the work into real wetland systems, you know. We're working on a study in Apalachicola National Forest that's in Sandhill, you know, a different variation of longleaf pine savanna that's in process also.
About how old do we know can a cypress tree get?
Oh, goodness. I am not the expert, but okay. There's a chronology that Dave Staley did using some cypress from Wakulla Springs and around the southeast that goes thousands of years.
Wow.
At least 2,000 years, but I don't know specifically. The longleaf pine stumps that I get, I've collected many different places, and it seems like the late 1400s is as far back as they go. So they were cut, you know, say 1900. Longleaf pine can live up to 500 years, rarely, but usually 300, 400. And these stumps, we have the inner wood, not the outer wood, which rots away. So it seems like that's kind of the limit, like the late 1400s so far is the limit as far as back in time, how far we can go. But cypress grows to be much older, and the stumps are much older, and could potentially go back 1,000 years if you found the right site.
That's amazing. So as we wrap up, and also too, as I guess as the world changes and we face more extreme weather events and warming, you know, talk about the importance of having these ecosystems maintained the way that they want to be maintained in the face of a lot of change. And
so it turns out that if these areas are burned like they were historically, which is very frequently, then there's less effect of like drought or, you know, with a changing climate, a lot of forested systems are subject to having super severe fires that impact, like out west. You have fires that kill the trees, and then there's no regeneration and all. But here in the southeast, if we burn frequently, like the historical record shows, it kind of buffers it from the climate change problems, and is a really good thing to do.
Yeah. All right, Jean. Well, thanks for coming in.
All right. Thank you, Rob. You do such great work highlighting all the incredible natural areas and people. I really appreciate you.
Thank you.
You can find the illustrated version of this podcast at wfsu.org/ecologyblog. From there, you can find links to the clips I included in the show, from the Finding the First Floridians documentary and the segment on frosted flatwood salamanders. That and many other stories on fire ecology are on the WFSU Ecology Blog. The WFSU Ecology Blog. Not a flashy name, I admit. Names aren't always my strong suit. When we were starting a new ecology podcast, my first thought was to come up with a name that matched the blog, the WFSU Ecology Pod. That was shot down. So I asked my friends and family to help me, and I received a lot of great submissions. I could have gone a dozen different directions and been happy with the result. The winner, as you may have figured out, was Costa Canopy. This name was submitted by Ecom Acosta, a friend of mine from Miami Killian Senior High School. We both left South Florida for college. I went to FSU and she went to UF. And that's okay. She currently resides in Boynton Beach.
So you submitted, like, I'm counting here, over 10 different options for a name for a podcast. And we picked Costa Canopy, but there were a lot of other good ones. But what I like about a lot of them are, like, some of them, like salt marsh and sawgrass or palm pine and mangrove echoes of the Everglades, is that they have like a South Florida kind of flavor to them. So what kinds of nature things do you do for fun in South Florida?
Oh, well, I recently got into geocaching a few years ago, and that's been fun. It's taken me on a lot of hikes, and it's a really good way of learning about your community without going too far. I lived in Pembroke Pines for a few years, and it took me 2 years to find a little bird habitat that I found geocaching, and it was really cool. It was like a little bird sanctuary island. But I've always enjoyed hiking, and I just think geocaching is cool just because it takes you into unknown places that you've never been before, and it's just like a fun little scavenger hunt. I think one of the coolest ones that I did find in the Everglades, it was in a log, but it was a skull in a log. So the cache was inside a skull, and that was really cool, very creative. And they have different levels of difficulty. If it's a hard to find cache, like it's camouflaged or it's just really well hidden, it's a 5. And then the terrain also goes from 1 to 5. If you have to climb a tree or a crane or go in the water, it's like a 5. So that's fun.
Nice, nice. How remote are places where people hide caches? Like, are they like deep Everglades, kind of like you have to get out of a canoe and find them, or is it?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, sometimes it could be in like shopping malls, like outside Home Depot in a bush. And that's kind of funny because people are walking by and you're like rummaging through a bush like a weirdo. But then there's really like hidden ones. That there's one, the Ghost Orchid Cache, that I didn't go on, but it's, you hike into this, I don't know, middle of nowhere, deep in the Everglades. And it's really rare because it only like blooms once a year or something. And it's like a whole expedition.
When you were in Gainesville, talk about like, yeah, exploring the area around there and how much was a lot closer to you compared to like in South Florida, where, you know, if you want to see some nature, you're going to get in a car and, you know, drive out for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. Here, every time you want to go anywhere, you have to take the turnpike for hours and then see the same grass on either side until you get to a foresty area. Over there, you just go outside and take a drive. And there's so many natural areas around there. There's Devil's Millhopper, which is like a sinkhole, and it's huge. Sometimes, I mean, if it's rainy, you'll see it, you know, like pool, but then when it's dry, you can really go down there. And I remember the Lake Wahberg. It's the university lake. It's like a little hangout resort, little thing where people go play volleyball. If you have a student ID, you can get in for free. And I used to go out by myself and study. I used to get a kayak and just go in the middle of the lake and just study there. Nice. And it's cool because you can kayak by the gators. They'll just be floating around. So the first couple of times were unsettling, but then, you know, you get used to it. Yeah. But there was a lot to do. I mean, I remember Paints Prairie is huge. It's got like a couple of different areas you can, little trails. And you know, there's wild horses, alligators, you hear them in the bush, and then you see the, you know, the paths that they make. The bison, I've seen deer.
What do you get personally out of a nature experience, especially when you get further away from it all?
It's the peace, and I guess just the connection to yourself, and I guess spirit, you know, because when you're out there, you have no distractions, and you can really like sit with yourself, and you feel just the awesomeness of nature. I mean, I remember I love driving through the mountains. We don't have mountains down here, but when I have the opportunity, it's just nice. It feels different. You feel like a different energy. You feel different. I don't know, the stillness. But at the same time, there's so much going on. So it's that paradox of quiet, but it's the power that it has. You know, you hear just the sounds of nature, the wind and everything. It's just, you feel everything bigger than we're just like dulled in a city with like constant, you know, stimuli everywhere. So it's a different kind of intensity, but it fills you with more peace, if that makes sense.
Thank you to my guests, Dr. Gene Huffman and Ecom Acosta. Costa Canopy is a production of WFSU Public Media. Taylor Cox was our audio engineer, and music was provided by Tallahassee's own Tracy Hornbeam. Costa Canopy is hosted by me, Rob Diaz de Villegas. Again, if you want to see images of tree cross sections and of the longleaf habitat, you'll find them and a lot more at wfsu.org/ecologyblog.